Bum 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 bum. It was just the usual small talk of the very rich, who are indeed different from you and me. They have tails. Little, short ones with smooth, silky hairs right at the base of the spine. If you ever want to know whether somebody is very rich or not, just pull down their pants. If they're very rich, they'll have a tail. No kidding. Impy orders more cold duck. I ponder life. Dean Martin doesn't drink nearly as much as he pretends to, but William Faulkner used to drink a lot. So did F. Scott Fitzgerald. Cole Porter was queer. None of the other Beatles liked John's wife, Yoko. Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas were lesbians. Don Rickles insults everybody all the time, but in private, he's really a kind-hearted guy. Somerset Maugham was queer. President Eisenhower had an affair with his female chauffeur during World War II. Elton John is queer. Tyrone Power was actually very short. David Bowie is queer, and I think Paul Lynde is, but I'm not sure. Anyway, Hollywood Squares is all rehearsed ahead of time. Janis Joplin used to take a lot of pills, and Princess Margaret wants a divorce. James Baldwin is queer. I know these things because of all the really famous and important people that I hang out with all the time. And the only reason that I'm living at the Y and being a male prostitute is because something really, really terrible happened to me. But I don't know what it was because Truman left the plot outline on a bus. But I'll tell you something I do know. I know that this isn't parody. I mean, what you're reading right now. Because parody implies some respect, however grudging, for what's being parodied. Parody pays its subject a backhanded compliment. This is not parody. This is Truman being dragged through the gutter and peed on by dogs. That's what they're doing to Truman. They're dousing him in kerosene and setting him alight in a ditch, metaphorically speaking, of course. But what do I care? I'm just the fag narrator. And anyway, you should see the movie deal. Whew! Here's Truman's laundry list. 6 shirts, no starch. 1 bathrobe, 12 bed sheets, pre-soak, 5 pairs Bermuda shorts, 8 pairs jockey shorts size 52 ultra brief, 1 truss, 2 dish towels, 4 hankies. This book is the real stuff, all right, the real inside dirt. A lot of people have committed suicide since the first excerpt was published, an out-of-work electrician in Dayton, a teenage mother of 4 in Memphis, and a woman with incurable cancer in Maine. Just to name 3. It's a roman à clé, you see. Truman's calling the bus company right now about the plot. Incidentally, there's no truth whatsoever in that rumor that lots of the writing is being done by a 15-year-old boy he picked up in the Greyhound station. Christ, I'm practically 20. Back in Le Café, all the famous people who ever lived on Earth have just spilled the beans about everything you ever heard of. Monsieur Olay has told a waiter to pick them up. Truman's tired now. He wants me to go help him make wee-wee. Is this 2,500 words yet? That's what we promised the Lampoon. Close enough for government work, huh? Continued on the moon. The problem with communism. Editorial from the 1979 Politics issue. What's there to say about communism anyway? I mean, besides that it's bad and don't do any of it. We all know it's bad. It's bad because it's based on unsound socioeconomic premises, has no respect for individual liberty, produces a totalitarian autocracy in every example of its practical application as a system of government, and plenty worse besides. But that's not why it's really bad. Who cares about all that egghead guff? The real reason that communism is bad is because it isn't any fun. It's no kicks, no giggles, no laughs. A 9-inning goose egg in the hoot and holler league. And there's a simple reason why that's so. Communism is no fun because of communists. Why, your communist is the type of guy or gal who only cares about great big rights and wrongs, the really tremendous and large ones, the size of whole countries and stuff. And there's nothing worse in the world than somebody who cares about rights and wrongs that big. Now, everybody cares about regular rights and wrongs that are about our size. Your wife, for instance. Just what has she been doing during the day? Do you think that's wrong? Would it be right to give her a pop in the yap? Everybody cares about rights and wrongs like that. That's only human. That's what keeps us from being like animals, and only having rights and wrongs that you have to pee around the boundaries of to get established. Human beings should never have to pee on anything to establish their rights. That's written straight into the U.S. Constitution, I think, or should be. Incidentally, what your wife's doing is wrong, and it's all right to hit her in most states so long as it doesn't leave a mark. But these other rights and wrongs, the really big kind, are a different matter. When people start getting thoughtful about these, it just louses them up. That's because if you have a gigantic right, well, it's just too big to ever really get to see much of. And if you have a huge wrong, it's just too enormous to ever get it fixed. Whereas little rights and wrongs, the kind normal people like us have, aren't that fancy. I mean, sooner or later, the old sow runs off with a Bible salesman, or, at worst, you go to jail for a while. But the people who care about the great big rights and wrongs never get them to go away, and this turns these people sad and gloomy. Not that being sad and gloomy is what makes such people so awful, because some sad and gloomy people, you know, the kind who drink for hours and then suddenly jump up and rip the bar stools out of the floor, are interesting and more or less okay sometimes. But it's different with the sad and gloomy people who care about big rights and wrongs, who are sad and gloomy, and also really drips and spades. They're whiners and criers, and nothing is ever right so far as they're concerned. Somebody's always being persecuted against, or exploited on, or suffering with something somewhere, and we should all be out doing something about it instead of just having fun, like drinking gin or getting a little leg in the back of your Ford. This is what the communist-type person says. And look at their countries, such as Russia. No good bands, no dance halls, no racy movies, no spicy magazines, no horse tracks, no burlesque shows. They don't even have modern art. And there is nothing on earth more boring than modern art, but even that's too exciting for them. This comes from having a country full of communist-type people, the kind of people who worry about great big rights and wrongs. I'm here to tell you that turns them into dips and limpwicks and weenies. I don't know how it works exactly, but it does. Maybe thinking about all that big important stuff makes them sit the way they all do. You know, with their legs crossed at the knees and pressed together too hard so that the lower part of their body doesn't get as much blood as it needs, so that they don't develop all their sex hormones, which are the hormones that make you want to have a good time, and therefore they don't want to drink a lot and eat good food and get loved up like we do, but just want to worry instead. Whatever it is, it makes for the kind of person who, when he was a kid, used to do next Tuesday's homework on last Friday night, if you know what I mean. Lots of times he used to be a minister's son, which isn't a communist exactly, but usually was a Presbyterian, which is not as bad but still stinks. Well, what you did to the minister's kid was tie him to a fence post with his pants off and dip his pecker in fresh cream and turn a half-weaned calf loose on him, which is exactly what we ought to do to all the communists in the world, except with atom bombs. Narrator's note. The next page contains a flowchart entitled, How Fluoridated Water Turns Kids into Communists. The chart is broken into four tracks. I will read one track at a time. How Fluoridated Water Turns Kids into Communists. Track 1. City government puts fluoride in public water supply. City government takes care of teeth. Child thus assumes that city government will take care of everything. City government fails to take care of everything. Child is embittered. Embittered child engages in antisocial behavior, making himself unpopular. Unpopular child associates with oddball element. Oddball element contains numerous socialistic and fellow traveler types. Improper associates and dangerous propaganda result in child joining Communist Party. Track 2. City government puts fluoride in public water supply. Child no longer feels responsible for own tooth care, thus stops brushing teeth. Halitosis resulting from unbrushed teeth causes child to become unpopular. Unpopular child associates with oddball element. oddball element contains numerous socialistic and fellow traveler types. Improper associates and dangerous propaganda result in child joining the Communist Party. Track 3. City government puts fluoride in public water supply. Because it is normal to ingest one drug, fluoride, child assumes that it is normal to ingest other drugs, LSD. Child ingests LSD. LSD causes child to become insane. Insanity results in child's unpopularity. Unpopular child associates with oddball element. Oddball element contains numerous socialistic and fellow traveler types. Improper associates and dangerous propaganda result in child joining the Communist Party. Track 3B. City government puts fluoride in public water supply. Because it is normal to ingest one drug, fluoride, child assumes that it is normal to ingest other drugs, LSD. Child ingests LSD. LSD causes child to become insane. Insanity causes child's judgment to be impaired. Child is thus an easy target for communist propaganda. Improper associates and dangerous propaganda result in child joining the Communist Party. Track 4. City government puts fluoride in public water supply. Improved dental health results in fewer visits to dentist's office. Fewer visits to dentist's office make for less frequent exposure to Reader's Digest. Less frequent exposure to Reader's Digest causes child to be insufficiently alerted to the dangers of communism. Child is thus an easy target for communist propaganda. Improper associates and dangerous propaganda result in child joining the Communist Party. So Drunk, Macbeth. A tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury signifying nothing. Enter a messenger. Thou comest to use thy tongue, thy story quickly. Messenger. I should report that which I say I saw, but know not how to do it. Act 5, Scene 5. Author's note. I confess to a nostalgic affection for this failed experiment in narrative technique. It's not a short story. It's not even fiction. But I assure you, it's also not fact. Not unless my drinking has led to much worse loss of memory than I can remember. I suppose you could call it a tall tale, or, to use the proper academic term, baloney. Anyway, So Drunk has the distinction of being the only piece I wrote for the National Lampoon that the National Lampoon wouldn't print. We had no fear of publishing sexist, racist, perverted, fascist, or communist articles, but when Julian Weber, president of the company that owned National Lampoon, saw this, "P.J.," said Julian, "the only people left on Earth willing to advertise in this damn magazine are liquor companies." I was going to vigorously defend my work on highly principled grounds of First Amendment rights and artistic freedom. Then I reread it. "If we have to choose," I said, "between liquor companies and the Constitution," said Julian, "let's have a drink." There are times I wonder how you survive. There are times you can abandon any attention to consequences, any inhibitions, any pretense to self-control, and just slide for weeks and still emerge unscathed. I don't know how this works, and after you reach a certain age or position in life, it doesn't. It's like St. Peter on the water, or a cartoon character who has overrun a cliff. The instant you have a self-conscious thought, you fall. But until then, you slip away in an entropic blur of grace, immune to retribution from the havoc you generate. I often think the universe exists in this condition perpetually. Not that my friend Ivan would know. He is just the opposite, always caught for every crime and made to pay on every debt, and he never takes a chance but loses all he stakes. Still, it's with poor Ivan that this adventure begins and ends. He stands in unhappy contrast to my general good fortune in misbehavior, though to what instructive purpose I don't know. Ivan's bad luck was proverbial. In the summer of 1969, He and I were living in the basement of an old house in Baltimore. We'd divided the cellar with used shower curtains. I'd swept out my half and had in there an army cot, my knapsack, a table, and one chair. Yvonne's half had the untouched dirt of 200 years, with a rotting mattress on the floor and a great litter of tools and metal parts and sculptures, for Yvonne was an artist. Every month his half of the basement, and only his half, would flood. 3 or 4 inches of foul Baltimore groundwater would seep in and recede, leaving a stink, after which I would burn incense on my table, and he would curse and sleep in the landing of the basement stairs. During one dry period, Yvonne took his motorcycle apart and brought it down into his room and rebuilt the engine and painted the frame, only to find that, reassembled, it was too large to get back out again. We had to take a wrecking bar to the stairway and hoist the thing up with a block and tackle. The landlord was crazy with anger, and we came and went through the foundation windows or by climbing a rope to the first floor until we were evicted 1 week later. Yvonne then decided to move to a crumbling slum on the Baltimore waterfront, where he found a 3-story wooden building from which an Armenian, or a Lebanese, or a gypsy, or some such, sold rug scraps and brass things. This foreigner had his shop on the first floor, and he and his family lived behind it, leaving the top 2 stories vacant. These were a wreck and were rented by Yvonne for $75 a month. He enlisted me and those few of his other friends who would risk being anywhere near Yvonne while he operated a power tool to help him fix it, promising us all free rooms when we were done. This would still, he said, leave him space for a studio in what had been an attic before the roof collapsed. So we worked on this place, tearing out plumbing and putting plumbing in, and jury-rigging electrical wiring and hauling out loads of cracked plaster mess and broken lath, and dumping it in the harbor in the middle of the night. I say we, but it was Yvonne who did almost all the work. The rest of us, me and Joe the poet, and a couple of others, would hammer and haul for a while and then retire across the street to Nick's Hotel, which was a flop house with a bar downstairs, where a draft beer was 15 cents. Every now and then, one of the winos who lived above would die, and what Nick called the pie wagon from Johns Hopkins Hospital would pull alongside the curb, not bothering with lights or sirens, and orderlies would carry the dead man out on a stretcher while we bellied up to the bar to make room for them to pass. Yvonne labored for months, and we were almost ready to move in when a fellow walked out of Nick's one night, crossed South Broadway, went into the rug scrap store and shot its owner in the face with a .45. When Yvonne arrived the next day, there was an entirely new family of foreigners in there, and they screamed at him and chased him out. The fat women, pulling their skirts up over their heads and exposing vast patches of genital hair, which seemed to be some awful insult among these people. Indeed, Yvonne said, it was nothing a heterosexual male should ever see. So all his work was as they say, nothing. Next, Yvonne was giving a crabby girl he'd screwed once or twice a ride to the 7-Eleven on his motorcycle. He was going around a curve when he hit, he swears, a patch of ice, something that does not much exist south of the Mason-Dixon line in September, and went headlong into a truck. The girl was crippled, or said she was. Anyway, she limped when she thought people were watching, so Yvonne, out of pity, married her. Pity is not a sound basis for marriage, Yvonne said he discovered later. And worse, he said, he discovered a crippled wife is not grounds for divorce in Maryland, even if she nags. After 4 or 5 months, Yvonne began hiding from his wife. He was hiding at my house when we began the longest drunk I've ever been on. Joe the poet was hiding at my house, too. I don't know whom Joe was hiding from. It may have been the finance people who were trying to repossess his television, but I don't think so, because he'd already dropped it out his second-story window. Or maybe it was his landlady, through the glass tops of whose cucumber frames the TV had fallen. But I don't think it was her either, since Joe had so terrorized the old woman that she collected her rent by thrusting a garden rake out her chain-locked door and making him spindle a check on its tines. Maybe he was just hiding. I remember he said, "I won't be found here." And that was especially true if nobody was looking. I was hiding from, or rather was intrigued from, a love affair that I couldn't have made worse if I'd married the girl. which was just what I wanted to do. Her name was Vicky Lewis, and she had agreed to it. Then she disappeared, leaving no hint of why or whereabouts. In stories more romantic than this, such women vanish due to dark secrets in their past. In ordinary life, they do it because they're nuts, which made me nuts, and we were all hiding at my house. Now, if you drink a lot, and I do, it's hard to date the exact nascence of a blender. When is it that ordinary heavy drinking leaves off and a true bust, a tear, a bat, a jag begins? There's drinking in the morning. That's one sign, of course. Unless it's beer. There's nothing more delicious with sausages and eggs than beer. And a medicinal shot or two doesn't count. And if it's getting on to 11 o'clock, and in those days I was never awake before, it's nearly lunchtime, and you can hardly say you're launched on a Houlihan with a drink or three before the midday meal. Then there's the shakes and a bleary thirst, but those signify alcoholism, which is but the sickly repetitious cousin of a real rampaging toot. No, I think, at least with me, I'm on a bender when I start carrying a drink, a real drink with ice cubes in a cocktail glass, with me wherever I go. To the grocery store, for instance, or to the bank, or into the shower, which is a better place than you might think if you pour your scotch strong and use plenty of ice. A little warm water never hurt a good blend like Chivas or Dewar's, but a single malt should only be had on the toilet or at the sink. Not that we could afford scotch in those days. We were drinking Maryland rye and screw-top wine and cheap gin with reconstituted lemon juice squirted in to kill the oily smell. After several days of this, we were on a binge by any definition. We certainly were by the time Joe threw his marijuana at a hippie. It made him sensitive to smoke the stuff, he said, and he couldn't bear the thought of that. Then he went off to fuck a fat girl to get diet pills so we could stay awake and drink some more. This must have been about February 1970, when we were drinking so and staying up all night. One morning the weather turned sunny and extremely warm, 55 or 60 degrees. We got on our motorcycles and rode into Western Maryland, where Yvonne's cousin, who was also a sculptor, kept a studio in a converted barn. This cousin was on a sabbatical to Brazil for some reason, and we broke into her house and drank all her liquor and ate up the canned goods. I think we ruined some of her artwork, too, though we didn't mean to. Her sculptures were airy, light, gauzy, stupid-looking things made of thread, yarn, and filament strung every which way. And Joe walked right through one of them. Some other of her pieces were rope and cord and woolen stuff tangled into wall hangings. We took these down later and slept on them. She had a woman's liquor cabinet, with a dozen bottles of 1/10 empty dairy product aperitifs and mocha marzipan cocoa butter flavored cordials and other silly things to drink after dinner. These didn't sit well with the handful of pills we'd brought along, and Yvonne threw up in what he thought was a bidet in the middle of the room, except it proved to be a work by a woman potter friend of the lady, or that's what the paper plaque attached to the base said, according to Joe, who had found Yvonne's cousin's flashlight and was using it to go through her lingerie drawer. The place had a lot of rustic decorative touches, and we couldn't find a light switch. Joe wanted to, as he put it, roar through the woods. So we roared through the woods, or we tried to. But maybe roaring through the woods takes practice or a special talent. Yvonne tripped over a string of barbed wire and vomited into his own face. Joe and I ran a little ways and yelled a couple of times, and then we were out of breath, so Joe went inside and had more to drink. After that, I wandered through, rather than roared through, the woods, and I wandered into a long, narrow, stony clearing where I half passed out, sure that I could hear the heartbeat of Vicky Lewis pounding louder and louder, making the earth itself shake beneath me, until I realized I was lying on a railroad track. I found my way back, eventually, to the house or the barn or whatever it was, and crawled between the wall hangings and poured Mars bar-flavored alcohol all over my face until I slept. But Yvonne came to an hour later and woke up Joe and me, saying we had to help him chain his motorcycle to a tree. Yvonne had a lousy motorcycle, a two-cylinder Jawa with Siamese heads, a pig of a bike. The only person for 100 miles around who'd steal a motorcycle like that was Yvonne. but it had to be chained up, and he put the chain through the wheel and around a tree trunk, and around his ankle, too. Then he dropped the padlock key. And though we searched until morning, we never found it. So we left Ivan chained to the tree and put everything useful we could find within his reach, toilet paper, matches, cigarettes, creme de menthe. Then Joe and I rode back to Baltimore to find a pair of cable cutters or a hacksaw or something. But we were hungover, so we stopped at Nick's hotel first. And after we'd had 8 or 10 beers, we were falling asleep, so we took some more Dexedrine, and then we had a couple of shots to take the edge off of that, and by then we'd forgotten Ivan. I decided I had to kill Vicki Lewis. Joe said he thought that was a good idea, and maybe he'd kill the girl he was in love with, too. Or maybe he'd just borrow her car. I couldn't go shoot somebody on a motorcycle, he said. A motorcycle makes too much noise. So we rode to his girlfriend's house and parked our motorcycles in a flower bed and took her car. Then we went to my house and got my pistol and began to drive. We'd been driving for about an hour when Joe said, "Are we there?" "Are we where?" I said. "Where Vicki is." "I don't know where Vicki is," I said. "If I knew that, I wouldn't be this drunk." Joe wanted to know how I was going to kill her if I didn't know where she was. So I changed my mind and decided I would forget about Vicki, the girl who I loved in Baltimore, and go back to Kathy, the girl who loved me in Akron. It took us a long time to get to the airport because, since we hadn't been going anywhere, we had no idea where we'd gotten to. So we turned around and went the other way, which was a mistake, because I think we were at the airport when we decided to go there, but I'm not sure. Anyway, I accidentally bought a ticket to Toledo, Ohio, where I was raised, instead of Akron, Ohio, where Kathy lived, but I didn't realize it until I'd gotten where I was going and found out I wasn't there. During all this time, I remember nothing about money. I must have had some, but I can't remember where I got it. I was always broke in those days. I used to sell drugs sometimes, but I doubt I ever made more than $40 or $50 at a time. I can't remember any other source of cash. I don't know. Joe and I took the last of the diet pills in the airport bar. Then I went to get on the plane, walked through the metal detector, and was jumped by a dozen policemen, plainclothesmen, sky marshals, and whatnot. I was dirty and addled-looking, and much in need of a haircut, and I had checked no luggage and carried none, and I must have fit perfectly some preconception of a hijacker. Also, the metal detector had screeched like a fucked cat. I had the plug wrench for my motorcycle shoved down in one jean pocket plus a big ring of keys and a Zippo. But what I did not have in my pocket was the gun. As I don't know where the money came from, I don't know where the gun went. I had it on my hip when I got in the car to go kill Vicki, and Joe said I didn't take it out, and he didn't find it in the car. I didn't find it again until that spring, when it turned up in the pocket of my only sports coat while I was packing to move. Eventually, I did try to kill Vicki with it, but that time by accident, and that's another story anyway. So they didn't arrest me. In fact, they apologized, and I had as much to drink as I could on the plane and flew to what I thought was Akron and walked and hitchhiked toward what I thought was Kathy's apartment and wound up in front of my mother's house. She wasn't home, but her car was there, so I took it. My mother had a clapped-out old Buick, a 1963 Invicta estate wagon. But it had the 401 cubic-inch engine that Buick used to put in its big cars, 300-odd horsepower. And even with 90,000 miles on the car, it would go 100 miles an hour. The left wiper blade broke in a freezing rain near Sandusky and began to flail and hammer against the windshield. I tried to fix it without stopping, but the whole thing came off in my hand. I had to drive with my face out the window and buy a bottle of brandy to keep warm. I slowed down to 80, but that wasn't slow enough for the bald old tires. On the turnpike outside Elyria, I tried to pass a car and went sideways out of control into the left lane. I steered with the skid as well as I could, but when I poked my head out the window to see what was going on, I saw a big slow truck in the passing lane. I tried to drift back to the right, but the driver I had passed had, as a past driver always will, speeded up and was square alongside me. After that, there was a whirl of vehicle sides and a truck behind. There's certainly an explanation for the money I spent on this trunk, probably something I've forgotten, and the same must be true for the gun that got into a sports coat I hadn't worn since a traffic court appearance in 1968. But there is no way to explain how I survived in the Buick. All I know is that the next time I could bring myself to open my eyes, I was in the clear, whole, and untouched. Albeit I was backwards, facing the car and the truck I must have somehow slipped between. Alberto Ascari or Juan Fangio or some such famous race driver is supposed to have gone off the course on a road race circuit once and driven between the gateposts of a house and up onto the lawn. And when the distance between the gateposts was measured, it was found to be less than the width of the car. He must have been drunk, too. The Buick continued to rotate, and when the front end was within 15 or 20 degrees of forward, I took my hands off the wheel, stamped on the accelerator, and the car straightened out, still doing 80. Kathy from Akron did love me once, I think. But I hadn't visited or called or replied to her letters in more than 2 years. I didn't even know that she still lived in the same place. But she did, and she was surprised, and not pleasantly, to find me filthy, wet, wild-eyed, and inebriated at her door. It was a peculiar evening. Her boyfriend was away somewhere, so I took a shower and some of his clothes. But it needed a lot of talking, more talking than even I can do, to get her into bed. I woke the next day with an erection and a headache, and I looked around for Kathy, but she wasn't there. There was no note. She didn't come back. I waited all day and drank and ate most of what was in the house. When she hadn't returned by 2 in the morning, I tried to leave, but the car wouldn't start. So I went back and drank and ate the rest of what was in the house and took all of her boyfriend's drugs and stayed up all night and, I admit, did some damage to the place, breaking a piece of furniture or two and one glass and then another, up to about a dozen, and putting my fist through a pressboard wall. When it was light, I tried the car again. It hadn't started before, I think, because I'd had the trunk key in the ignition. I got some beer and drove to Columbus and found my friend Cullen Fitzpatrick coming out the door of a big rundown house he shared with 20 people. He was carrying an enormous backpack and a sleeping bag, and a folded-up pup tent and a pair of snowshoes, and was wearing a new down parka. He was hitchhiking to the airport, he said. He'd given away everything else he owned, and he was going to Colorado forever. We went inside and began to drink. We drank there for a while and then took all the camping equipment to Buck's Stumble Inn. The next day, or the day after, or maybe the day after that, Cullen told me again that he'd given away everything that he owned and was going to Colorado forever. But I said, why didn't he come back to Toledo with me? Because Toledo is further west than Columbus, and therefore must be nearer Colorado, even though it's more north, because it's less east. So doubtless the plane fare would be smaller, and besides, I'd stolen my mother's car. We fell into a dopey lethargy in Toledo. Fitzpatrick is given to periods of inertia anyway. He once lived with an ugly fat girl for 6 months because she had a Barca Lounger reclining chair, and she'd serve him meals in the Barca Lounger, and the TV was in front of the Barca Lounger, and she'd kneel down and give him head in the Barca Lounger, and then he'd tilt the chair back and pass out at night. She'd look the other way while he pissed in empty beer cans and tossed them out the windows. Every now and again he'd have to get up to shit, he said, and that was all. So we sat in my mother's living room, drinking the 2 cases of beer she brought home from work every day, until she got so angry at the bad impression we were making on her boyfriend that she told me to just take the car, for Christ's sake, and get out of there. Cullen wanted to go to the airport, but I said, no, come on, let's go down to Cincinnati. That's much farther south than Toledo, and therefore that much closer to Colorado. So we went to Cincinnati, but here I run out of adventures. No really sustained drunk consists of all Homeric moments, unless the drunkard is telling even more lies than I am. We stayed drunk and took as many drugs as we could find and stomach. But nothing much happened, nothing like what happened to a friend of mine, Mahoney, who was riding around with a friend of his and the other fellow's Austin Healy. The young man who was driving was very drunk and melancholy, and was telling Mahoney of his decision to commit suicide. Mahoney said, oh no, you'll feel better in a day or so, or maybe just after another drink. Mahoney gave him another drink from the bottle they were carrying, but the fellow said he had his mind made up. Everybody feels that way sometimes, Mahoney said. You'll never do it. The hell I won't, said his companion, and he drove straight off a curve and into a tree. and the steering column went through his chest, which is the way that all good stories of drunk should end, with a great catastrophe, a horrible death, or at least a sad, ironic turn. But neither this part of the story nor the story as a whole has that kind of ending, or much of an ending at all. True life, even loudly exaggerated, has deficiencies in organization and plotline, and a muddiness of symbolic content. It's hard to draw even the most common wisdom from the messy events of daily existence until they've been told over and polished and improved upon a few hundred times. Such as the story I heard in the French West Indies about a drug-smuggling pilot who was in San Bartolomé on a drunk, and between cocaine and chivas and more cocaine and rum, hadn't slept in 4 or 5 days. There's a road out of Gustavia, the main town on the island. It goes up a steep hill to the top of a bluff, then turns to the right along a ridgeline. When you come up this hill and reach the turn, you can see, some 50 feet below, the island's landing strip, which runs out from the bottom of the bluff to the sea. This is particularly impressive on a moonlit night, with the marker light stretching down each side of the strip and the painted center stripe aglow. The smuggler pilot was driving up this road from Gustavia on just such a night. And when he reached the top of the hill and looked down, he forgot he was driving a car and thought he was landing a plane. He adjusted the vent knob, which he took to be the throttle, yelled, "Gear down! Flaps down!" and went right off the top of the bluff, over a stone wall, and upside down into a hedgerow. I understand he still flies a plane, but will not drive a car. Mahoney will still drive a car, but he won't ride in one when someone else is driving. He says he'll tip a cab driver $50 to slide over and let him take the wheel, and he says he'll never again argue the question of suicide. In fact, he says, he won't even discuss abortion. But nothing of this sort happened to Cullen and me in Cincinnati. Though we were smoking hashish on the roof of a house one afternoon when somebody who was with us said that the treetops, which came up around the eaves, were certainly soft and fluffy-looking, cuddly and cushiony, he called them, and we agreed, more or less. And then he ran off and flung himself into one of them, and was badly scratched and broke a thumb when he hit the ground. That night, I think it was, I met a girl in a bar who was going to Pittsburgh. I convinced Fitzpatrick that there was really no difference between Toledo and Cincinnati, both being about the same distance east of Colorado. And I convinced the girl that Toledo was north, so it must be on the way to Pittsburgh. The three of us drank until the bars closed, and for a while after that. Then drove 200 miles back to my mother's house, arriving at 10 in the morning. We were awakened at 4 in the afternoon by my mother, who was screaming and throwing us out. When I'd taken my mother's car to Akron, she'd reported it stolen. But when I brought it back, she hadn't reported it returned. The highway patrol couldn't find the car while I was driving all over the state, but they found it easily enough while my mother was driving to work. She'd left her driver's license and identification and so on in another purse, and had had to spend the day convincing police she wasn't a car thief. We hitchhiked to the airport, dragging Fitzpatrick's equipment, and when we were there, and with the help of a bottle of J.W. Dant, I convinced him that Pittsburgh, too, was on the way to Colorado. We didn't get that far. We were thrown off the airplane in Cleveland. While we were in the airport bar, the girl, who was named Candy or Katie or Cora, disappeared. I don't know where she went. Cullen got the bartender to bet him that he would not drink a flaming hooker. A flaming hooker is a shot glass full of Bacardi that is set alight and then drunk to the amazement of bystanders. We'd turn the lights off in the bar to dramatize this. The trick is to do it fast, before the flame heats the rim of the glass, and to do it in one motion, so that the fire is smothered in your mouth. But the bartender had substituted a 3-ounce juice tumbler for the shot glass, so there was more liquid than Cullen could get down in one gulp. He was a spectacle with his mustache alight. The result was a sort of toasted Amish look, with a fringe of smelly beard char left around his face. We got on another plane, and this time neither of us paid any attention to where it was headed, which was Washington, D.C. From there, we made it the 40 miles or so to my place in Baltimore in only 3 days. By then, Yvonne was out of the hospital, where he'd been treated for exposure and alcohol poisoning. He and Joe were getting ready to leave for a college in southern Maryland, where Joe had been invited to give a poetry reading at a writer's workshop populated, I understand, by middle-aged women with a bent for historical fiction who planned to write under pseudonyms of three names. Personally, I don't remember anything about the audience except a shocked hush. Joe had decided it would be more fun if he took friends along to read with him, even though none of these friends was a poet. Actually, that's not true. He did turn up one other poet, a strange young man named Nevin, who had devoted 4 years to composing a 50,000-line dramatic versification of Maeterlinck's Life of the Bee. Nevin's interpretation of this book was in no wise hampered by having read it, and his ignorance of his source was surpassed only by his ignorance of its subject. He insisted on giving his reading dressed in a bee costume, which he made by tying an imitation tiger skin lampshade to his rear end, wrapping his arms in packing tissue, and holding the broken-off end of a bamboo fish pole between his teeth to represent the stinger. The man had absolutely no idea how a bee was constructed. His reading was not very popular. Neither was Joe's, though it was shorter and, if slurred, much easier to understand, since he held nothing in his mouth but the neck of a whiskey bottle, and that but momentarily. Fitzpatrick said he didn't know any poems, but knew a good story about a poet, one of the original beat poets, who got stoned one night and decided he was hungry for chili and made a big stew pot of it. The poet seasoned the chili with jalapeno peppers. He tasted it and thought it was good, but not hot enough, so he put in some more jalapeno peppers. That was better, but it still wasn't hot enough, so he put in more jalapeno peppers yet. Finally, he put a whole quart jar of jalapeno peppers into the chili and sat down and ate the entire potful. He wound up at 6 in the morning, Fitzpatrick said, on his hands and knees in the bathtub, running his butthole under the cold water tap. I don't remember what I did at the reading, but earlier we'd been given a dinner by the college president, and Ivan amazed everyone by eating a whole chicken without using his hands. We were asked, then told, to get off campus. Hints were made to us concerning the state police, and the college people should have called them, because it was definitely not safe for us to be on the highway. We were taking mescaline, which doesn't mix with whiskey. It makes you argumentative without the capacity to follow the argument, and combative, which it is difficult to be when you're in combat with things that aren't there, and even more difficult when you're in combat with things that are. Cullen got on the wrong side of a giant redneck in a roadhouse on Route 301, and we had a fight with everyone in the place. We escaped without many injuries, really, except for Yvonne, who took a bar stool on the forehead, and we had to make a sort of sacrifice of Nevin in his bee costume. Nobody ever saw him again. But the mescaline began to give us stomach cramps, and Joe sideswiped a couple of cars. And by the time we got back to Baltimore, we were in bad shape. Joe's girlfriend, especially, since it was her car. When we got out, she jumped back behind the wheel and started chasing Joe down the street in it. That was the last I saw of Joe for a while, galloping down the middle of the road with this crazy girl trying to run him over, and him without enough sense to jump up on the sidewalk or behind a tree. Then Yvonne and Cullen and I began to really drink. We'd been drinking before, yes, but it was nothing to this. We'd been on a cheerful, circumstantial, convivial sort of drunk, or I had anyway, for nearly 3 weeks, but now we went at it as an assigned task, as a measure of will, as a test of the body physical. We drank and puked, and drank and passed out, and kicked each other awake and drank some more and still kept drinking. I don't know why. Maybe we thought to reach some zenith, some efflorescence, some supreme perfection of uttermost drunk, and so to be done with pleasure for the rest of our lives. It's hard to say. We got very drunk, but we did not succeed in becoming the drunkest people ever. Fitzpatrick's father told a story about those folks which he used to tell before he died of drink himself. It seems that one evening a group of senators and representatives were drinking in a Washington bar. They were getting drunk. First, they got pretty drunk. Then, they got very drunk. After that, they got drunker than anyone had ever seen senators and representatives get, which is very drunk indeed. And all the while, their colleagues were coming into the tavern and getting as drunk as that themselves. Finally, the entire United States Congress, with the possible exception of a lady senator from Maine or so, was as drunk as a coot, skunk, monkey, hoot owl, red Indian, or anything else that you can be as drunk as." About 2 o'clock in the morning, the Speaker of the House stood up on a table and said, "Gentlemen, we are sloshed. We are fried, oiled, canned, and in the bag, cross-eyed. We are awash in tonsil paint, afloat upon a sea of cough and varnish. We are swimming in stagger soup. We are lit, tight, stinking, bombed, and tanked with 3 sheets to the wind. In point of fact, we are drunk, and in point of more fact, we are drunker than anyone has ever been. And in point of more fact than that, we are drunker than anyone is ever going to get, because we've got a quorum right here. So let's go over and open Congress." Which they did, stumbling up to the Capitol building and unlocking the door. Then they called themselves into session and passed a law saying no one could ever get drunker than they were then. And that's where Prohibition came from, according to Fitzpatrick's father. And I did not even personally succeed in becoming the drunkest I have ever been. The drunkest I've ever been was when Fitzpatrick and Uncle Mike Visconti and I were all in college. One night we were having a party and ran out of whiskey at 3 a.m. Uncle Mike and I went out into the country and woke up a moonshiner we knew. He brought us out some pop bottles filled with clear liquor that had little pieces of things floating in it, like river water has. We took it back to the party and everybody drank it, and it gave us a woozy, crazy, different sort of drunk. Very nice until people began throwing up. But a certain amount of throwing up is expected at a good party, required even if the hosts are to know that the full thrust of their hospitality has been felt. It didn't seem to me that anything was very wrong until I saw my girlfriend Juanita, normally a fastidious girl, retching into a sink full of dirty dishes. I had a few more drinks and I was sick, too, sick as I've ever been. I felt my insides pulled out on a rope of filth. It was a convulsive projectile vomiting that brought no relief. I remember puking into a waste paper basket, through a window, out the back door, into a plant, and onto the Davenport. Finally, exhausted, I crawled upstairs to the bathroom. I woke up with a burning sensation in my gullet and a horrible headache. It was a struggle to open my eyes, and when I did open them, there was nothing there, just a blank expanse of whiteness. I blinked and rolled my eyes in their sockets and blinked again. Nothing. Nothing at all. Nothing but a featureless white glare. I was blind. Blind, I thought. I drank moonshine whiskey and it made me blind. I'm blind, blind. Wood alcohol, blind. I can't see a thing. I'm blind, blind, blind. And I was half an hour like that until Juanita came in and found me just where I'd passed out, with my head upside down in the toilet bowl. So we didn't get as drunk as you can get, but we got as drunk as we could, and coming after so much drinking before, the effect was bound to be bad. There was nasty business with 3 high school girls. I wish I could remember some of it, but I can't. I don't remember anything. I'm not really sure the high school girls were ever there. Were we so drunk that... so drunk that what? I have no idea. That's the problem, finally, with getting so drunk. The next thing I truly recall was Fitzpatrick and I in the filthy bathroom at Nick's hotel, and we each had hold of one of Yvonne's arms. Yvonne had passed out while taking a crap and had fallen back with such force that he'd gotten his head stuck between the wall and the standpipe behind the toilet. We pulled on his arms, each of us bracing a foot on the porcelain bowl, and his skull came loose with a pop. Yvonne's eyes opened, and he pulled his pants up and said, "Boy, this is an awful job." "What job?" said Fitzpatrick. "Being longshoreman," said Yvonne. When we came out of the bathroom and back into the bar, the place was filled with longshoremen, and we were apparently longshoremen, too. We didn't remember being hired, and we didn't remember unloading any boats, but there we were, and all the other longshoremen seemed to know us. Yvonne got up the next morning and went to work, and to the best of my knowledge, he's a longshoreman in Baltimore to this day. Cullen and I did not go to work. Cullen packed his tents and sleeping bags and rucksacks and so on, and hitchhiked back to Columbus. He never has been to Colorado, not even to visit. I eventually recovered and got a regular job, but not before I went on the wagon. And I'm going to go on the wagon again just as soon as I finish typing this. Why I'm Not Afraid of the Dark. Editorial from the 1981 Kids issue. When I was a child, I was, as most children are, afraid of the dark. I insisted on a nightlight in my room and a lamp left on in the hall. I did not like to go to the basement after sundown, or into the attic at any time of the day. The stairway to this attic, in fact, opened into my bedroom, and I could not comfortably get in bed until I had checked the door lock at least 3 times. I hated to look into a dark window from a lighted room, and if I was left home alone, I would pull the shades and drapes. Outdoors, the dark was somewhat less fearsome, at least when I was accompanied or there were plenty of street lights around. But to be outside by myself on, say, a windy night without moon or artificial illumination was horrifying. So much is not unusual. I understand it is considered normal and even healthy for a child to feel this way. But when I grew older, the fear did not diminish. On the threshold of puberty, I was more frightened of a dark room than I had been when I was 5. As my mind developed and my imagination improved, nameless dread gave way to vivid phantasmagoria, and general mental unease was replaced by specific terror. I was no longer afraid of just the dark. Now there were things in that dark. Summer camp was agony. Staring out the cabin windows, I slept so little watching the wolf ghouls and bear ogres formed by the breeze in the treetops that I had to be sent to the infirmary, and there slept not at all, on a bunk above a boy who had been bitten by a spider and claimed his leg was rotting. I could smell it all night long. I once spent my Christmas vacation with an aunt and uncle and had to share the bed with a younger cousin, who had the disquieting trait, as some people do, of sleeping with his eyes open. I would have killed him if I hadn't been sure he was one of the undead already. I developed a custom during those 2 weeks of getting up and going to the bathroom 6 or 7 times after I'd gone to bed, in order to be back in the light with the adults. It was a habit that took years to break. And when I was fully 13 years old, I could not fall to sleep in a Florida motel room, because the owner had decorated the place with a luminescent picture of Jesus on the Mount of Olives, and the phosphorus paint formed horrible patterns in the dusk. The thing was awful on the wall, worse under the bed, and still unacceptable face down in a dresser drawer. It finally wound up outside behind the ice machine, and if the owner of the Gulf View Courts in Pensacola would like it back, it's probably still there now. The fear, of course, was unpleasant, but the embarrassment at having it was worse. I was, I thought, for all practical purposes, an adult. I would be in high school the next year. Soon, I hoped, I would be taking girls to bed, and presumably that would be in the dark. I wished for, more than anything except perhaps those girls, freedom from this panic. As it happened, quite apart from my fear of darkness, I was having an uncomfortable childhood. My father had died when I was 9, and my mother, a kindly but not very sensible woman, had remarried to a drunken oaf. He was a pestering, bullying sort of man whose favorite subject of derision was my fondness for books. But when I did try my hand at sports and fishing and so forth, he teased me for my ineptitude. He described me as a hothouse flower when I stayed inside, and claimed I was running wild like a juvenile delinquent when I went outdoors. I was accused of spinelessness when I did not respond to his goading, and of impertinence when I did, told I was dumb when I was quiet and to shut up when I spoke. My mother tried to intercede, but this only made things worse and made me feel like a coward and a mama's boy besides. As for the remainder of my family, I had only a pair of nattering younger sisters, and I did not like them any better than I liked the rest of the household. Weeknights at home were the most difficult. Our house was cheap and small, and it was impossible to get away from the others. My bedroom was above the living room, where they all sat and watched television from sundown until bedtime. I could hear every word they spoke, many of these words being about me and what a problem I had become. Then my mother would come upstairs every half hour or so to ask, "What are you doing?" And if I tried to go down to the basement, which, as I mentioned, I didn't like, my stepfather would yell, every time a commercial came on, for me to leave his tools alone. This was very painful. Not many of those tools were really his. Most of them had been my father's. And if I tried to sit in the kitchen, which at least kept them from talking about me in the next room, then I would be criticized for moping. Therefore, most evenings, wet or dry, cold or warm, I would sneak out of the house and walk around. The single explosion of abuse that I'd receive when I returned was preferable to the constant multiple irritations I received if I stayed. and though I was scared of the darkness outside, I was not as scared of the darkness as I was exhausted with my family. Most of the time, I was not even really that scared. We lived in a city neighborhood. It had lawns and trees and so on, but there were busy streets nearby, and I would meander along the well-lit storefronts, avoiding alleys, parks, and other dark places, supporting my timidity fairly well, and hoping and mooning and worrying the way adolescents do. I tried to calculate my return with precision, so that I would be late enough for the stepfather to have drunk himself to sleep, but not late enough for my mother to have called all the neighbors, or worse. There was one night, however, when I would not have gone out if things hadn't been much worse than usual at home. My sisters became engaged in some prolonged and stupid screaming match with each other, and I had slapped the louder one to shut her up. This set off a general row in the house, so that by the time I bolted for the door, my sisters were shrieking like banshees, and my mother was crying aloud, and my stepfather was bellowing threats, and the dog was barking, and the television was blaring in the background of it all, a scene I still envision whenever I hear the phrase, "hell on earth." It was moonless and very windy, and there was an overcast that blotted out the stars, but was too high to reflect the city lights. It was early spring, I think, and still cold, and the wavy forms of the naked tree branches were especially macabre. I stuck close to the store windows and huddled in well-lighted doorways several times for warmth. I was doing just that when a police car stopped. "What was I doing prowling around in the middle of the night?" said the officer. "I wasn't prowling," I said. "I was just walking home and got cold and stopped for a second in the doorway to get out of the wind." He pointed out that it was not my doorway to stop in, and that, anyway, stopping in doorways was suspicious activity at that time of night. He asked me where I lived, and I told him, since I could not think of a lie. He said I'd be plenty warm, he thought, at least on one part of my body, if I were to arrive there in a police car instead of immediately under my own power. So I strode off in the direction of my house, attempting to look purposeful, and turned into a darkened playground where I was out of sight and a police car couldn't follow me. There were no lights at all on the playground, and besides the spectral things I always felt around me in the gloom, I was worried there might be corporal bums, or drunks, or, worse, older teenage boys there, too. I was frightened, but I was stuck. I couldn't go back to the main streets, or else the police, I was sure, would get me. And I couldn't go home. I couldn't bear to do that. So I stayed where I was, trembling and miserable. And after a while, I began to think. I did not really believe that there were monsters in the shadows, and I didn't see any drunks or teenagers. But this did nothing to allay my terror. I must have read somewhere that it was useless to rail against panic, that the source and causes of fear should be examined and meditated on, to see if the fear will respond to reason. And I was not completely ignorant of primitive psychological theory. I asked myself why I was afraid of the dark. Nothing very bad had ever happened to me in a dark place that I could remember. No. The worst things in my life had transpired in broad daylight or well-lit rooms. It, the darkness, must symbolize something to me, I thought. I had only recently heard about symbolism, and I thought it was a swell concept. Perhaps, I thought, darkness symbolized the death of my father. But I could remember being afraid of the dark before he died. And, in truth, I had not been that close to the man. It was his absence in the present, not his loss in the past, that was sorely felt. I didn't think his death was it. I decided darkness must symbolize something more general for me. Evil, I decided. That's why I imagined monsters in the dark. Monsters are evil because they do evil things, which is what makes them monstrous. But I recognized that as circular reasoning. No, I had to consider what evil really was. Evil was harm and destruction. Murdering people, that was evil, or burning their houses down. These were the sorts of things evil forces might do, the kind of forces that darkness symbolized for me. Such forces might rage into a home like my own and murder one of my sisters, or both of my sisters, or even my mother, and tear the house to pieces, breaking it into little bits and then blowing the ruins to smithereens with nitroglycerin, and setting fire to what was left. And then take my stepfather and break both his arms and slice off his feet and poke his eyes out with red-hot staves, disembowel him, and skin him alive. And then they'd attack the rest of the neighborhood, and the police force, and the school, and burn and bomb and steal and break everything in that part of Ohio, from the filthy oil refineries on the east side of town, all the way to the moldy, boring cottages we rented every summer at the lake. And who knew what such evil forces might do after that?